5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more, sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Hey, all. Welcome to How to Fix It. I'm John Avlon, journalist, author, recent congressional candidate. And the purpose of this podcast is to focus on solutions, not just fixate on problems, to talk about ways we can move forward together with reforms that can appeal to the moderate majority of Americans. And at the heart of a lot of our division and dysfunction is Congress. And our guest today, Yuval Levin, noted conservative scholar at AEI, editor of National Affairs, author of many books, including American Covenant, is focused on this idea of specific reforms to Congress to make it more Madisonian, to focus on building coalitions so we can reason together again and our laws will have legitimacy rather than just being jamming ideological extremes with very narrow margins. This conversation, we're going to talk about reforms like expanding the members of Congress, a big idea. We're going to talk about changes to the committee structure. We're going to talk about election reforms like ranked choice voting that he believes can help lead to a higher quality of candidate. But this is an urgent conversation, and it's one that really does bridge those divides. Yuval, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
So, look, you've written so much. We could nerd out on Edmund Burke all day, but we're just going to focus on this narrow swath. Let's talk about some of the proposals that you've made, some of which are big and bold, and some of which might strike people as process-oriented, around reforming Congress. There's the institutional piece and the electoral piece. Let's start with some of the institutional changes you think we can make.
So, you know, I think maybe the place to start is to think about what is it that Congress is not doing. If you ask Americans, is Congress working well? No one almost, aside from friends and relatives of members, is going to say Congress is doing great. But what is Congress failing to do is actually a more complicated question than it seems. Because I think a lot of people at first glance would say, what Congress is failing to do is pass the big legislation that I care about, whether that's fixing entitlements or environmental regulation or whatever is the big issue for you, immigration, healthcare. It's not doing it. That's true. It's not doing it. But I would argue that if you begin from the Constitution and ask what Congress is supposed to do and isn't doing, the answer is actually something more like Congress is failing to facilitate cross-partisan bargaining and accommodation. That's the purpose of the institution. Congress produces legitimacy. It produces public action that is understood to be legitimate by as broad a swath of the public as possible. Its job is to facilitate bargaining. Now, the fact that it's not doing that is also why it's not passing big legislation. but it's an underlying reason. And the difference is important because if you think the problem is Congress isn't passing big legislation, then you'd say the solution is make Congress more efficient, make it easier to get things through. But if you think the problem is Congress is not facilitating bargaining and accommodation, efficiency actually is not the answer, because what you want is to force members to deal with each other, and especially to deal with the other party. My view is what Congress is fundamentally failing to do is to facilitate cross-partisan bargaining. And that means we have to think about ways of both empowering those parts of the institution where bargaining can happen, especially the committee system, and of forcing members to deal with each other. So not making it too easy for parties to govern on party lines exclusively, not making it too easy for leaders to just have their way all the time. And so what you want is some decentralization of power. What you want is, again, some empowerment of the committees. And the kinds of solutions that I start with, therefore, don't look like what some congressional reformers, especially on the left, tend to argue for. I don't think we should eliminate the filibuster, for example. I think the filibuster is one of the only reasons why there's any cross-partisan bargaining and accommodation. I think we should look to empower committees, first and foremost, above all, to disempower leadership some, but not to the benefit of individual members, the way that, say, the Freedom Caucus wants to do. I don't think that makes sense. The core work of Congress has to be done by the committees, and that's really a lot of where I would start.
So you're what I would call a classic conservative. But what you're arguing is that James Madison's conception of the Congress is all about creating an environment to broaden coalitions. So this is not sort of the ideological jam it down your throat approach. It's the exact opposite. It's how we can create a context in which people can work and reason together, which I would say is sort of is a centrist priority. But this is really key because right now under Donald Trump, I think the ideological approach seems to be, you know, a narrow win is a mandate for radical change. And what you're saying in a classic conservative way is, no, we need to find ways to reason together. That's Madison's original conception. It's Woodrow Wilson who sort of got it wrong. So what are the ways to do that? Especially, you know, I'll just mention that the neutering of, you know, Mike Turner at the request of Donald Trump because he was too presumably hawkish on Ukraine, too tough on Russia. That's a sinister thing in your sort of conception of empowering the committees, isn't it?
I absolutely agree with that, yes. So I would say, first of all, the essence of the Madisonian system is coalition building. And that means that the American system is different, even from other democracies, other perfectly legitimate democracies. Just approach this question differently and say, when you win an election, you win all the power. And so if you have a majority coalition in Parliament in Britain, you control the government until you lose your majority. The American system does not work that way. What you win at election time is you win a seat at the table. And what happens around that table is negotiation. And so even when you've had a great election, let alone a really close election like we just had, even if you win big, what you win is a seat at that table. And there's always a necessity for coalition building. That means that the tendency to centralize power and polarize power in Congress, which has been the strong tendency now for an entire generation, is very much at odds with the Madisonian logic of the system. And the fact is we've just lost the knack for thinking in terms of coalition building, so that when a new president comes in and has some agenda, the natural thing now is to say, well, how are Republicans going to do this on their own? How are we going to do this through a legislation that can overcome the filibuster, do it through reconciliation, rather than to say, how are we going to build a broad coalition that can accomplish this in a bipartisan way? And the point of bipartisanship is not some kumbaya, let's all get along thing. It's to build a coalition broad enough to result in durable legislation. Because anything you do on a party line vote can be undone on a party line vote. Anything you do by presidential action can be undone and will be by the next president. And to have actual durable change that allows for some stability in how we govern ourselves, we have to think coalitionally. And that will require a real change of mindset on the part of members. Republicans now have the narrowest House majority in 100 years. They have basically a two-seat majority. And yet still, they're not thinking, we want this tax bill. How do we get 30 Democrats to vote for it? You could absolutely get 30 Democrats to vote for a tax bill that most Republicans would want. But that's not even on the table as a strategic option for Republican leaders now. I think the loss of the sense that that's how Congress should work is the biggest problem here. And a recovery of that sense has to precede the particular sorts of changes that could, again, empower committees or allow for legislation to move in traditional ways.
So let's flesh that out.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, do you believe that Newt Gingrich's changes sort of precipitated this decline of regular order in the committees? And then how to restore that? I mean, people irrationally respond to incentives, positive or negative. What are the structural reforms that can bring about that cultural change, specifically as possible?
Yeah, I think some of the changes that Gingrich advanced, and I should say I worked for Newt Gingrich right out of college, and I enjoyed it, and I liked what he was doing. In retrospect, a lot of it was very bad for Congress. And it was very bad for Congress because it wanted to centralize power in the hands of party leaders. I think Newt Gingrich was the most Wilsonian, in the Woodrow Wilson sense, leader of the Congress in the history of the institution, and had a sense of who the speaker was that was a kind of prime minister in a presidential system. And that was never going to work. It did not work. It will not work. But everything we've done since then has been further in that direction. I think Nancy Pelosi built on Newt's changes. The Republicans who followed since have continued to do that. To recover a functional capacity for coalition building, I think you have to start at the committees. And one thing that I would do is Congress should learn from the state legislatures, which is not something that you would have said throughout most of American history.
No.
Generally, state legislatures are the very definition of dysfunction. Today, the state legislatures, almost all of them, work better than Congress. And a lot of the reason for that is that they do begin from the assumption, even in states where there are large partisan majorities, that you're going to proceed by building coalitions. So, for example, in many state legislatures, 18 of them now, committees control floor time. So if you get a bill through committee, in some states, it's if you get a bill through committee with at least one vote from the minority party, which is an idea that I like, then that bill gets a vote on the floor. In the House of Representatives, a bill doesn't get a vote on the floor unless the speaker wants it to. So a committee can work for a year, produce legislation that's negotiated by its members, and the speaker will say, well, this isn't really on our agenda for this year, sorry. And it never goes anywhere. That leaves members thinking that the work they do in committee just doesn't matter. And they're right. It doesn't matter. Ultimately, the big bills get worked out in the leadership offices at midnight before a government shutdown. Sometimes they'll use some of what the committee's produced, but many times they won't. And you have to help members feel like they're firing with real bullets when they do their legislative work. Here, I think incentives are really crucial. One thing that James Madison understood was that institutional rules create institutional culture, right? People in Congress are ambitious men and women. They want to succeed. But Congress gets to define what success means. And so if success means that you prove that you're able to advance legislation, that's a very different culture of Congress than if success means that you've got a big following on social media, which is what success looks like now. So right now, an ambitious member is right to just spend all of his time building his social media audience. We need to get to a place where an ambitious member is right to spend a lot of his time in committee trying to get work done. And right now, they're not wrong to think that that's a waste of time. So allowing committees to control some floor time, allowing the authorizing committees, the ones that write legislation, to actually spend money. The line between appropriation and authorization that's existed in the House for the last century or so is not written in stone. It didn't come down on tablets from Mount Sinai. It was a decision they made. Congress didn't work that way in the 19th century, for example. There were reasons they made that decision, but I think it's time for them to rethink how the committee system works, how the budget process works, which is a very poor fit for the contemporary Congress. These kinds of questions are how you could change the culture of the institution.
Most folks might not fully appreciate how undemocratic little d the current process is. You can have legislation that's been worked on by a committee that represents a supermajority of American, you know, popular opinion, and it can be blocked from getting a vote just on the whim of an individual speaker in this case.
Yes.
And increasingly, a speaker doing the behest of the president, which itself undermines separation of power. So empower committees.
This is a very important point to stress because a lot of this is about the president now. Whether it's about fighting the president or helping the president, Congress has come to see itself as serving the president. And this has been going on for a while. I'll tell you a quick story. Mm-hmm. I worked for George W. Bush. I was a White House staffer in his second term. And in early 2006, there was a bill moving through Congress that he opposed, and it looked like it was going to pass. It was a bill to overturn his own funding policy on stem cell research. And he said he would veto it. So as it became clear that it would pass, we had a brief meeting with him just to confirm that he wanted to veto the bill. And he said, yeah, I've said I'd veto it. I'm going to. And we get up to leave. This is about 10 people in the Oval Office. And he says, well, now, to veto a bill, what do we actually do? What, do I sign something? This is 2006, okay? It's in his second term. It's 5 years in. But in fact, that bill, which did pass that summer of 2006, was the first bill that George W. Bush vetoed. He went 5 years without using the veto power. And the reason was the Republican Congress, which he had for those first 6 years of his presidency, didn't pass anything he wouldn't sign. I think that's a failure of the system. That's a Congress that sees itself as existing in the service of the president. And we see it now, too. Republicans were trying to figure out how they were going to get the budget through or voting for a speaker. And you find members saying, well, the president should have the speaker that he wants. No, that is not how our system of government works. Congress has to have some institutional pride that says what we do here drives our system. This is where decisions are made. And that is not how Congress works today.
At all. And more to the point, it doesn't work. And let's talk about the budget, because that's the most basic responsibility. And yet we live on these sort of crumbs of continuing resolutions where the most extreme members effectively dictate what's in big bills. Republicans for a long time had been saying they want standalone bills and clean votes, but now Trump wants everything put in one big omnibus to jam through every aspect of his agenda. What's the right way to reform the budgeting process? One idea that had been put forward in the past was no budget, no pay, right? Which is simple, but basically focuses the mind. If you don't pass a budget, you don't get paid. Somehow, I think most folks think that Congress would find a way to reason together under those circumstances. What are your prescriptions?
Well, I think to begin with, what we think of as the budget process, and when people say regular order, they're talking about that. That's a process that Congress created in 1974 for a very specific reason. There was a tension between a Democratic Congress and a Republican president, Richard Nixon, and the Democrats wanted to wrestle back some control of the process, and they passed a bill in 74, the Budget and Impoundment Act, and that created this process where you have to pass 12 bills, and it begins with a budget resolution. There's an argument for it. There's sense to it. But you know what? Congress should ask itself, how today, in the 21st century, should the federal budget process work? And members should recognize that they don't have to live the way that Congress did. That Congress was 20 years into what would be a 40-year run of Democratic control of the House, uninterrupted. And so that budget process was created to serve the interests of the Democratic Party when it thought it would always control Congress. We now live in a Congress that is very closely divided. Control goes back and forth all the time. And Congress should ask itself, what should the process look like now? I actually don't think that an omnibus bill is such a bad thing, for example. An omnibus bill compels negotiation. It allows people to patch together things so that I get something, you get something. Maybe there's a way for Congress to think about the budget process that actually takes that for granted, that says, this is how we do things, so let's create a process that helps us do this in an organized way rather than forcing ourselves into this thing we're never going to do. Since 1990, the Congress has followed the 1974 budget process one time, 1997. That's it. That means that process isn't the budget process. And so why are we pretending that it is? I would say a few things. One significant change that Congress should think about has to do with the distinction that now exists between appropriation and authorization. That is, some bills create programs or change them, some bills spend money on them. Why are those not the same? Well, there's a reason. The reason it's not the same is to try to control levels of spending so that there's an overall budget level. But what it means is that the authorizing committees very often don't do anything. For years at a time, they're not really passing legislation. If you allow members in the work they do in those committees, which is most of their work, to also decide what spending levels will be, they'll be much more invested in that work. And the budget process, rather than being a purely appropriations process, can be a kind of ongoing process where in small chunks with little bills, you decide what you spend on programs. Or patch it together and in one big bill, but you decide what you're doing and what you're spending at the same time. I think for the modern Congress, that would make a lot more sense. Now, the appropriators aren't going to like it, the people who get to spend the money, but everybody else would like it. And it would also help the leadership in a way that I don't think they see, which is leaders right now, just they think they need control. They want to be able to control everything because what they're promising their members is, I'll never make you take a tough vote. So I'll make sure you don't ever have to vote on something that makes you uncomfortable. Leadership would actually be stronger if they said, look, I don't run everything. You all got elected just the way I did. And so let's have a process where committees work out negotiated bills and then we vote on them. And if we don't like them, we vote them down. Rather than say, everything is up to me, a speaker should be able to say, this is what this body wants to do. And it's not all up to me, it's all up to us. I think that's a process that would work better to facilitate negotiation, and it would actually help the leaders not bear all of the burden on their own, so that you get to a situation, as happened in the last Congress, where the Republicans fire the speaker because he passed a budget with Democratic votes. I'm sorry, that's his job description. That's what he's supposed to do. And to find that unacceptable is to get to a place where being a legislator isn't really what you want to do.
And that's where we are, right?
That's where we are.
You know, how many government shutdowns, playing, you know, chicken with the debt ceiling, and the only way anything ultimately gets done is, you know, a majority of Republicans with Democratic support, sometimes even a minority of Republicans. That's the way government is supposed to work. And yet that is not only seen as the last ditch solution, but a firing offense in the case of Kevin McCarthy. This is a Congress that has completely lost the plot. And I do think that reforms can help do that. I want to highlight what you just said, too. People, you know, in their own daily lives at work might understand that one of the definitional nightmares is when you have responsibility but not authority, right? Separating the appropriation from the legislation creates that circumstance. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. And what I hope we can move to, and especially given the fact that pendulum swing with congressional control is happening so often, why do we not have more of the common sense Lincoln idea of the politics, the golden rule?
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
What more can we do, and maybe this is the segue to talking about the election reforms, to change the incentives so people actually have that enlightened self-interest that's necessary in a democratic republic where you think about what's good for the country, not just good for my party. What's good for us if we're in the minority or the majority? What are some of those election reforms you think we could put in place?
Yeah, I think this does point to election reform because the strongest incentive that members face is the electoral incentive.
Yeah.
They want to keep their job, they want to be back there, or they want to make progress in their political career. And so what matters to them is how do you get elected? And the way that we've come to answer that question is very peculiar. Over time, gradually, the parties have, in essence, contracted out their fundamental function, which is candidate selection, to an almost random electorate of people who choose to show up on primary day. In some states, you don't even have to be a member of the party to show up. You just have to be enough of a political junkie to be a primary voter. And the trouble is, what's become clear over time is that the people who are intensely engaged enough to be primary voters are the people who least want the system to work the way it's supposed to work. They don't want to see compromise. They want to see ideological purity. They don't want to see working with the other party. They want the other party to look bad. And so any genuinely legislative bargaining that says, I'll give you something and in return I'll get something, is unsatisfying to primary voters. And as, especially in the House, seats have become less and less competitive in the general election, and the real election is the primary election, members more and more come to understand themselves as fundamentally answering to that part of the electorate. So that we now start every election cycle basically by asking the craziest people in America, what would you like to see? And then getting their answer and going from there. And that is not a good way for this system to work. So that I think we've come to a place where party primaries are not a good fit for what we need in our politics. This hasn't always been true. Primaries have been around a long time. They didn't cause this problem. But they're a very bad mix with what our political culture has become, with changes in the media environment, with changes in some basic assumptions about the nature of our parties, with polarization. And we're at a place now where the logic of the primary needs to change. Now, I think it's not obvious in advance exactly what kind of change would help. And I think we should use the fact of our federalism, of the decentralized character of our election system, to experiment with different forms of candidate selection. I'm a believer in the importance of the parties. I think we need strong parties. The parties are actually moderating influences because as institutions, they need to win elections in all kinds of places. So I wouldn't want to see electoral changes that weaken the parties too much. But I think that within the party system, we can experiment with forms of candidate selection that are not simple open primaries. One example, it might be ranked choice voting, ranked choice in primaries, where, again, the kind of skill you need to build coalitions is also the skill you need to win in a ranked choice election. You need to be able to be some people's first choice, many people's second choice. That's the kind of personality you want in politics, and it's not the personality we get in the primary process. But it doesn't have to be ranked choice, and maybe it shouldn't be. I think we need to be experimenting. Parties need to be looking at different ways of choosing candidates. And the reason they should want to do it is that they're not winning right now. I think this is actually a peculiar, very strange feature of 21st century American politics. The parties don't see that they're failing. We've had now a 50-50 politics for 30 years, where every election is very close, congressional majority is very narrow, constantly over and over, control of Congress shifts back and forth, control of the presidency shifts back and forth. We've just had the third election in a row where the party in control of Congress has shifted. It's only happened one other time in American history at the end of the 19th century. This kind of 50-50 period is a period of party failure. And yet the parties don't think they're failing. They think the 50% plus one is a great election win. They think getting 49.8% of the popular vote is a massive landslide victory for Donald Trump. No, Donald Trump won by 1.5% in the popular vote. That's the fifth closest election in American history. And there's no sense within the parties that what they're doing isn't working. I think they have to recognize that they could win bigger if they tried. Run non-crazy people, and you could win bigger. Think about how to build a broader coalition, and you could win 55% of the vote. That would be massively different from 49% of the vote. To see that is the first step.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
I've spent most of my career warning about the dangers of hyperpartisanship and polarization, which I think, I mean, I've made the case that this is something that Washington and the founders worried about, and we've now metastasized into much of their worst nightmare. That said, I think redistricting reform is another piece, because here's where the parties are trying to sort of control outcomes. And if we had more competitive general elections, it would be an added incentive. But I do like ranked choice voting a lot. And I think that's a piece of the puzzle, because it tends to reward uniters, not dividers.
Yeah, for me, this has really been a lesson of this polarized period. If you'd asked me 10 years ago, I would have thought ranked choice is basically a kind of gimmick to get Democrats elected in Washington State. It's like, you know, okay, they want even more progressive leftists to win. I don't think that way now. I think ranked choice is a way to experiment with changing the kinds of people we draw into politics. And the nature of the failure of the party system that we've seen over the last 25 years should cause us to ask ourselves, how can this system serve its proper purpose? And its proper purpose is to populate a set of institutions that are built to facilitate bargaining. I think that's an assumption that a lot of voters don't start with and really need to be acquainted with.
Another aspect, and you may have evolved on this too, I think George Will, interestingly, did, is that for a long time, conservatives saying we needed more ideologically pure parties, right? There was a frustration with progressive Republicans and conservative Democrats, and problems certainly could emerge, but it made divided government functional because you always had that possibility of new coalitions.
Absolutely.
And I think that's something that has also hurt us, that people were arguing for, but I think now we've reaped the whirlwind.
Yeah, I mean, here I wouldn't say that I've evolved. I think our two-party system only really works if the parties are internally diverse, so that some of the coalition building that happens between parties in a multi-party system like in Europe has to happen within parties in the American system. And if the parties are too intensely cohesive internally, then there's no room for bargaining. There's no room for finding cross-partisan accommodations. And the system cannot work that way. None of our institutions can really function that way. So absolutely, I think there need to be factions within the parties. We really lack those now. The notion that somebody telling you they're a Republican tells you everything you need to know about their politics is not how our system is meant to work.
Could not agree more. Yeah, ironically, in this moment, a lot of Democrats are rediscovering the wisdom of federalism. And you are a big advocate for that. But one of your ideas, or, you know, this might have been under your national affairs umbrella, was actually expanding the number of people in Congress, which is radical to most people's ears. And yet, I think some folks might not fully appreciate that the number of people any one representative represents has grown exponentially. Talk to folks about that. I mean, that's a big idea.
This strikes a lot of people as a strange idea, because there are not a lot of people who look at the House of Representatives and think, I really wish there were more of these people. But to my mind, this is really just constitutional maintenance. The House was meant to grow with every census. That was the original assumption. It's not written in the Constitution, but it was absolutely the implicit assumption of the framers. And it happened every 10 years after every census until 1920. And in 1920, for their own reasons, for political reasons of the moment, members of the House decided not to do that anymore. And by statute, they stopped growing the House. The effect of that has been that each member now represents far more people than used to be the case. The average member of the House now represents 780,000 people. And that means that there are almost a dozen now House members who represent more people than some senators do. The House is meant to be much more representative than the Senate. And one way to achieve that is by keeping low that ratio of how many people each member represents. I think that if the House had kept growing, had just kept growing by the same formula that was used in the 19th century, the way that worked is after every census, changes in population would be distributed in such a way that no state lost seats in the House. So greater population would go to states who now have more people, but it would happen by growing the number of seats overall, and no state would lose seats. If you'd kept that formula, then there'd be about 150 more members of the House now than there are now. The House has 435, and we would be instead at 585. That's a perfectly manageable number. There are several state legislatures that are bigger than that. The House of Commons in Britain has 700 members. It's a manageable legislature. It would make a big difference to do it now. And the way that I would think about it is you would expand the House by 150 members now, all at one time, and then every 10 years you'd grow by that old formula. So they would grow much more slowly than that. The advantage of that is not only to make the House more representative. First of all, it would also make the Electoral College better balanced. The Electoral College, the way it works is every state has the number of members of Congress it has. And so if the House grows, so does the Electoral College. And some of the imbalances we have would be addressed that way. And it would also create a moment for other reforms, the kinds of things we've been talking about here, committee reforms, budget reforms. If you suddenly have 150 new members of the House, then members have to ask themselves, how's this place working? What else needs to change? The idea that nothing can ever change in Congress doesn't make as much sense when you have that kind of influx of new members all at one time. And I think you'd create an opportunity for some other needed reforms. And then the House could grow after each census in a way that would keep it connected to the scope of the population. This is absolutely how Madison thought Congress would work, and it's absolutely how it should work.
I love it. I love it because it's a big idea, but it's rooted in the founders' vision, and it's something that has potential to appeal across party lines. And that's where we really need to restore the focus. You know, there's a lot I admire about your work. The purpose of this podcast is to let's talk more about solutions. Let's talk about solutions that don't hew to one partisan or ideological outlook. One of your books, which I loved reading back in the day, was about Thomas Paine and Edmund Burke. Edmund Burke, obviously, considered the founder of conservatism in reaction to the French Revolution. We obviously are now living in a time where one of the many downstream effects of January 6th was that the ostensibly conservative party had an angry mob attack a Capitol. This is the opposite of its historic origin, right?
Yep.
It's always seemed to me that Burke is essentially a centrist. He wants evolution, not revolution. The tiny platoons. It's not a reactionary movement. It's not a tradical, what I would call tradicals is my current term for what we're seeing. Can we find some common ground there?
Well, yes, except I wouldn't call that centrist. So I think what you find when you look at the debates of the late 18th century in Britain and America is that there are two kinds of liberalism that become apparent in that era, one of which sees liberalism itself as a revolutionary mode of politics, as rooted in new ideas discovered in the Enlightenment that point toward radical liberation of the individual, the other of which sees liberalism itself as an evolved form of government that over time, over many centuries, came to a balance between order and justice that makes a free society possible. The first kind of liberalism I think of as a more kind of radical and left-leaning liberalism. The second is a more conservative, right-leaning liberalism. And Burke is really the embodiment of that second view. I don't think that's centrism. I think that's conservatism. But Burke is certainly a liberal. And I think conservatism in the Anglo-American tradition is best understood as conservative liberalism. And at the center of it is a disposition to preserve, to begin from the sense that what we have is very valuable and very fragile. And therefore, a strong disposition against radicalism. Today's right does not have a strong disposition against radicalism. And I think it's not Burkean enough, and I think it's not conservative enough. There's always been some tension between populism and conservatism in the American right. I think the right is stronger when conservatism is stronger than populism. And therefore, I think the right is weak now because populism is stronger than conservatism. And the challenge that presents is that we run the risk of failing to preserve what is most essential and fragile about our social order, taking for granted the sheer fact that a society this vast and diverse can live in peace. That is not to be taken for granted. That is not the natural order of things. It's an incredible social achievement. And to risk it the way we now risk it is a dangerous mistake.
I couldn't agree more. And while I will continue with my long struggle to more accurately define centrism in the American mind as not a midpoint between extremes, but a distinct ideology, I think your point is more academically rooted, which is that maybe the common ground is reclaiming liberalism. Maybe we need to make liberalism great again. In any case, Yuval Levin, I want to thank you for joining us on How to Fix It. I want to thank you for your scholarship, your ideas, and your sincere belief that the American experiment is precious and must be preserved.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.